Hello and welcome to another episode of Shuffling Notes, where we discuss songs, albums, artists, and all things music. So, I'm your co-host Prankit.
And I'm your co-host Ravi.
And today we will be discussing one of the more unique English rock bands. I mean, there's quite a few, but today we have The Who and their fifth studio album, Who's Next. So, you know, The Who, they were formed in London in 1964. And I'm not sure if you know, Razi, have you heard of sort of the mod movement or the mod subculture within the UK or England?
No.
So, yeah, this was, you know, I'm not too familiar with it as well. So, but this was sort of started in the 1950s. And I think mod sort of stands for modernists. Because they used to listen to like modern jazz and so forth.
Right.
When The Who were formed, they were sort of at the center of this mod subculture. And it's quite ingrained in their songs. And, you know, over time, the mod subculture also evolved. These are like a group of guys who'd like, you know, they'd so drive like the Vespa scooters. They'd sort of dress up in, you know, tailor-made suits. You know, it was quite interesting. So they started off as sort of a mod band. And they sort of transitioned more to pop rock as time went on. But yeah, what's your exposure been to Who? Uh-huh. I'm just wondering, you know.
Well, let's just say, to preface this, I can now put names to the tracks that I was just continuously listening to when you're in my vicinity.
Yeah.
But, now that I've listened to it over and over with like full intent to understand the words, the music, it's quite interestingly done. And I won't say it's a reveal video or my part will be a reveal video part.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, some inspirations that I've seen maybe from Who or by Who.
Yeah.
You know, like...
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see as we... Yeah.
Yeah, I will get into that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, suffice to say, you know, The Who are sort of one of my favorite bands of all time. You know, one other interesting aspect, I mean, they've always been a very sort of live band. So all their recordings are sort of generally done live in the sense of the band performing together, which is a lot of bands. But, you know, they've said in the past, they've never been able to capture their sort of the essence of their live stage performance on their records. They still prefer that people come watch them live. They're just a live act. And they used to do this thing called auto-destructive art, which is essentially at the end of the performance, they'll destroy their instruments. they've always been sort of a very live and interactive band. But this album, Who's Next, this was released in 1971. And I feel like this album does capture some of that live essence. And I think as we go through it, we'll discuss it. But, you know, just quickly going over, you know, we've got four main band members. We've got Roger Daltrey on the lead vocals. You know, he's got great live presence. He's always like throwing mics around and all sorts of things. And then you've got Pete Townsend, who's sort of the guitarist and sort of on the synth and organs. And sort of the backup vocals. But Pete is generally the overall sort of the main writer or composer of the band. He's sort of the visionary, so to speak. Then you have John Entwistle, who's on the bass. You know, he's sort of a lead bassist, so he's got a very unique style. And you have Keith Moon on drums. So, you know, this lineup, these four people, this was the original lineup for The Who. Up till, I think, the album after this, Who Are You? After which Keith Moon sadly passed away. And then, you know, over time, they've had, you know, different sort of accompanying artists live.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, it's mostly sort of Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend that they still do sort of live events and performances.
Right.
So just, you know, also just as a preface, you know, we are covering the album as it came out, which had the 9 songs that we will go over today. The album Who's Next on the streaming services, they're the sort of the remastered version and they have a lot more songs. you know, live versions and sort of demo recordings and so on. But we will be covering the original 9 songs that had come out, focusing on that.
I like how you put that.
Yeah.
The original 9 songs.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if you own like the original vinyl or LP or whatever, you know, that's how, that's what we're going to be talking about. And yeah, I mean, Who's Next is considered one of their best albums. You know, it has some of their most popular songs. So I think it's a good album to sort of start off with. Do you know, before we dive into the track list, the songs in Who's Next, originally, they were supposed to be a part of this rock opera called Lifehouse. I don't know if you stumbled upon that. So the Who 10, you know, they did a rock opera before this, Tommy as well. Right. And then Pete was working on this great sort of rock opera. Then it was supposed to be a film. And then it was supposed to be an actual live event where they tried to make the plot of the film into like a real thing. And then when all that failed, it ended up being a album, Who's Next? And they sort of chose these 9 songs from this massive Lifehouse project to be in this album. And I think now that you know that, when we go to the song lists, you know, some of the songs are more sort of are part of that rock opera. So they're telling us part of a story, which is not quite there yet, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that'll be, I mean, you'll have to fill me in on that, but that'll be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting to perhaps do a video of about Lifehouse, a separate video at some point, because from everything I've seen about it, you know, that was a crazy project, and it brought Pete Townsend to like the to the verge of like nervous breakdown, as he put it. So you know, that was a crazy sort of approach. And yeah, and I guess the last bit of sort of general thing is, I don't know if you saw the album cover. It's sort of the form. It's implied that they've just sort of urinated on this like monolith, which is supposed to be like a Kubrick reference. Apparently they approached Kubrick about a movie based on Tommy, which was their previous rock opera. And so there's some reference to that in the cover art.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, the stone thing, it did reference back to Space Odyssey, but and Space Odyssey also has opera in it. So like, okay, that's
parallel.
I can see some connections over there.
So yeah, let's I guess dive into the track list. So the first track we hear here on the album is Baba O'Reilly, and this is probably their most famous track, I'd say, right, Rosie? I think, you know, this is probably the track most people have heard, even if they haven't heard of The Who.
Even if they don't know the name of the track, they know, I've heard this before. Because it's, I think it's in series and movies. And
I mean, now so many trailers have, you know, the Stranger Things season 3 trailer had like a version of this song. Mm-hmm. And I think Free Guy, is that also, I think, had the Baba O'Reilly track. I mean, so the name of the track, you know, Baba O'Reilly, it refers to... So the first part is Meher Baba. It was like a, you know, Pete was very sort of going through like a spiritual phase. And he was a follower of Meher Baba's teaching. Mm-hmm. And then the second part, Riley, refers to Terry Riley. And, you know, again, the synth sound that's used here, which is the organ running through a synth. It was inspired from Terry Riley's work. So that's why they titled it Baba O'Reilly. Mm. I mean, what are your sort of general thoughts about this track?
I could pick out, like, I've got this section mark, which is at around 3:20 mark, where there's a music interlude. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of throughout, I mean, the whole song is a little glitchy, I would say. Or the feeling it invokes is kind of glitchy, while by this part it's like a little comforting. But this 3:20, and I think it's a 10 to 20 second interlude, and after that you just you sort of comforted into that zone, and then again you open your eyes and you're like, running by the end of it, because that's how the beat goes in the end. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's making you run to something or from something.
Towards the end, especially when it starts with the violin and it starts speeding up. That, you know, part, what it reminds me of is sort of like, I want to say, because it's not, I wouldn't say it's psychedelic, but it's almost like, you know, like Sufi, or even like, you know, like Jugalbandi in Indian music that you have. Especially that part with like where the violin is playing and you hear the drums and the organs, and then they start speeding up and speeding up and speeding up, and then there's almost like, I'm using a lot of Indian terms here, like tihai, you know, like they do it like three times, and you've got the violin speeding up. And so I do wonder, you know, that inspiration, that Meher Baba inspiration, I wonder if Pete was also like exposed to that type of, you know, Indian music. Because, you know, you wouldn't have a violin, you'd have sort of some other instrument in India, but, you know, it sounds very similar to that type of setup, with like the track speeding up right towards the end, and then you have like the climax of the song.
I think that Indian references were there in a lot of these, even the Beatles,
There was a whole phase of like Western music being influenced by more sort of South Asian music for a period.
Yeah, I think the 60s to 80s kind of music.
Yeah, it definitely comes through here as well. And, you know, so this track, like I said, because, you know, this track was also part of the Lifehouse project. You know, it's about the lyrics are supposed to be like a farmer singing a song before he begins, like in Exodus to London, but you know, the part where they mentioned the Teenage Wasteland, that wasn't originally part of the Baba O'Reilly track. That was a different song, and I think, you know, that part, "Don't Cry, Don't Raise Your Eye," is actually sang by Pete rather than Roger. That's why it sounds, you know, a little different. But it refers to, because, you know, I do wonder, like, what, you know, what do they mean by Teenage Wasteland? So what they refer to is, you know, in 1969, they had the Isle of Wight Festival. And afterwards, it was completely just garbage everywhere. Like, when everyone had left, the whole thing was like a wasteland. And so that's the Teenage Wasteland, sort of, I think, originally that Pete was referring to. But, yeah, I think, you know, lyrically, we'll see in a lot of the tracks, because they were part of this rock opera. I don't know if they sort of, you can see they tell like a part of a story at some point, but we don't have the full picture. And, yeah, I mean, the synth used in this song, you know, I think at the time it was considered very sort of revolutionary, because the synths back in the day, they were very difficult to use. And for this one, you know, he had done a setup where it had an organ that ran through a synth that then, you know, did the output. And, you know, it was considered very unique, having this type of synth sound in a sort of a more of a rock song at the time.
It is. It is unique, yeah.
I mean, I think that's why the song has aged quite well. Like, specifically Baba O'Reilly, you know, we still see it in trailers and stuff. It doesn't feel, it feels like a classic, but it doesn't feel old sounding. You know, it still has sort of a modern feeling. It's aged very well.
True.
But yeah, I know. I think, yeah, one of the best tracks on the album, I think, or the most sort of famous tracks on the album.
Yeah.
So, yeah, is there anything else you want to add to Baba O'Reilly?
Well, not to Baba O'Reilly, just to the whole picture of us going through the tracks. So I haven't researched much of the tracks. All the notes that I have is the feelings they invoked. And so I'm just glad you're ready to cover my part for that.
Well, I've been waiting for this whole my life. Yeah, no, I've been a big fan. So I've gathered a lot of info over the time. And, you know, some of it might not be, you know, if I'm remembering it correctly, I haven't double checked everything. We don't have a fact check. So let us know in the comments if if you do get something wrong here. But yeah, so, you know, from Baba O'Reilly, we move on to Bargain, second track. Now, you know, this song, going again about the research, this is actually directly inspired by the teachings of Meher Baba. Like, the first line, I gladly lose me to find you, is like comes from a phrase that was used by him. But I'd be interested to see, because I mean, if you know this and you listen to the song, you perhaps find more spiritual meaning to it. But I feel like otherwise it's very open to interpretation and sort of can be taken as a love song as well. I'd be curious to know what your feelings were.
It was a really good rock song is all I can say, because it starts off with a kind of, you know, push you in kind of tone, while you don't feel claustrophobic as well throughout the song, because it's, you know, they expand in different areas, different points of time, and there in this song is I begin my inspirations that I could see, or maybe I'm just wrong, but you know, I got a feeling of space oddity with the acoustic guitar in the beginning.
Yeah.
Like just for, I think that's the 10-15 second bit.
Yeah, it starts off with the acoustic guitar and the beats, and then the rock kicks in.
I mean, I was listening to it very offhand, and I would just have to check again. Hang on, did I put the right algo in it?
Yeah.
It was, so hang on, that sounds like space oddity. So like, I got the connection from there.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's just a glimpse that I was getting of different or some more tracks. Maybe it's an original thought of space oddity. So I haven't fact checked which came before, which came after.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, it starts off with that space oddity kind of similar tone. So you feel
before like Roger's singing comes in with like
it just becomes like the inspirational part that's in the beginning that space oddity is about.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you just sort of get into the rock zone of it.
Yeah, it just kicks in.
As you said, like it's the good references, especially the first line being a quote and all of that, that's actually good references. Yeah,
and you know, the part again in the song, there's a part where, you know, I sit looking round. I look at my face in the mirror. I know I'm worth nothing without you. That I think that also is sang by Pete, as opposed to Roger. So whenever they have like mellower parts of the song, sometimes Pete takes over. Because I feel like their voices do complement each other quite well. But Pete has said this is like his favorite song off the album. And I don't know if you've noticed. So, you know, what this song does is, and this is something we'll see some other songs do as well, is it starts off, you know, it starts off with the guitar part. And then, you know, the sort of the rock element kicks in.
Yeah.
And then it sort of transitions again to sort of a softer sound, you could say. When Pete is singing, and then it transitions back to rock. So it does this like back and forth, like the song has these segments, like a hard rock segment and then a softer segment and then a hard rock segment, which I think keeps the song sounding quite dynamic. You know, it goes like all the guitars and everything slow down and it goes more like piano based, and then the hard rock kicks in again, and then also the drumming changes as it goes through this transition, which I thought was quite interesting. And again, you know, like Baba O'Reilly, this song as well, you know, the lyrical content of the song ends and then it has like a long instrumental climax, so to speak. You know, there's quite a bit of just instruments playing until the song finally ends, which I think gives it a good climax. But also, I can imagine, you know, again, these songs feel like they're written to be performed live, because when you're performing live, you know, sometimes you just go on and on with the instruments, right? You finish the song, but you keep just jamming. And that's what a lot of these songs feel like, which is why I feel like they're captured.
Yeah, most of the songs have this this music interlude just post the mid-song part, you know?
Yeah, and it just goes on for quite a bit.
Then they end it probably add the music interlude, or then you know, they add the chorus back again, and that's where it ends. So that's parts there. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, from Bargain we get onto the third song called Love Ain't For Keeping. This is the shortest song on the album, actually. And I think the only song which does not have any sort of synthesizer in the background, any type of like synthesizer music. Yeah, so I mean, I'm curious to know, you know, what your thoughts were on this song as well, you know.
So you're just trying to, you know, push my story in the beginning so that you can like take your own break and
well,
just
yeah, I don't want to. I'm curious to know what you have thought about it before I tell you perhaps a bit more background on it, if that makes sense. Because now that you've told me that, you know, it's mostly your sort of feelings, you know, just
So this had very unusual lyrics in the sense of rhyming. Like, you know, the way they were approaching the rhymes throughout the song. Just tell me a few lines from the beginning.
Well, I can't remember line by line, but like the chorus goes alongside sort of lay down beside me, loving for keeping, like darling, lay down.
Well, the rhyme that they take, because it's, again, it's line by line. It's not one full line that they're singing. Yeah. So that rhyming section that they're taking, or the rhyming approach, is quite unusual, because otherwise, you know, the last words or last...
I can see like the syllables, babes are sleeping, loving for keep, like the alternate lines as well. Yeah, I see what you
but
mean.
But it goes in tune. It goes very much in tune with the kind of music they, you know, put into it. And,
well, I'm curious to know what you think. Is there, because, you know, the actual meaning, like loving for keeping, what do you think that means? Or is there anything that you think...
What I could understand is just that, you know, love isn't what is to be kept, or, you know, kept as in, love isn't something to be held on to.
It's for sharing,
let go.
Because the first time when I heard the song as well, you know, it was a while back, and I kind of got the feeling of the song, you know, there was like a, I felt like a romantic element to it, and it kind of felt like a more peaceful song. But yeah, you know, it took me a bit to get my head around the love ain't for keeping line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what exactly is meant by it. It took me a few listens. But yeah, I mean, this, you know, this is a more sort of, I want to say it's almost like country sounding song with like the acoustic guitars.
But I think in it's the mostly, beginning like, of the song.
Yeah.
In the beginning of the song, it's, so there's a song called Sweet Nothing by Velvet Underground. I think I did send you one short clip of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So God, again, I see some sort of, you know, parallels being drawn. But I mean, both of them are very different songs for very different purpose.
With the music, I think the intro music.
But yeah, that just, I think it's just the first few seconds. That's quite similar to how Sweet Nothing takes around the music post that, and they sort of push it into the rock zone, like the Who.
Yeah. Some things like that, you know, in this, specifically in this song, it is a short song, but some things that stood out to me were like, firstly, you know, it is mostly acoustic guitars, but even just with the acoustic guitars, they've made it quite complex. So like, you know, if you pay attention to like the riff that's playing on your right ear compared to the guitar, that's the rhythm that's playing on your left ear, there's like a lot going on just with the guitars. And, you know, this is again one of the songs I noticed the bass a lot more, like the bass guitar, probably maybe because this is more acoustic, so you notice the bass more. Because if you pay attention to the songs, even the first two, like the bass is always quite unique. Like John, you know, Entwistle, he's sort of, like I said, he almost plays like lead bass as opposed to just rhythm bass. And he's always doing crazy things with it in the background, if you pay attention. But in this song, I noticed it more, I think, because it's mostly sort of acoustic guitars, I think.
So this is one of the songs out of the whole nine songs, nine OG songs. That has a tune that I just find myself singing, just randomly. It's just
It's humming.
the love thing to keep and the beats that go with it. Like, I don't know, it's well made. That's all I can say.
Everyone's really just doing their own thing, but they're really in the zone, like John is just sort of playing his
Exactly.
bass
That's
and he's just lost in it.
the right way to put it.
And Keith on the drums. So yeah, from Loving for Keeping, we then get to the next song, which is My Wife. Now, this is the only song actually that is not from the Lifehouse project. And this is actually written and sang by John Entwistle, who in this song also plays the piano and he also plays like the horn or like the brass that you hear along with the bass that he is playing. Because I think they went to John and they were like, "Do you have a song ready for the album?" And John had this song he had worked on for his solo album at some point, but he never got around to, I guess, releasing it. So he proposed to put this album in, put this song in this album. So it does sound a little different from the other songs, but it's quite an entertaining song, I thought. It's quite fun.
So the one reference that I can pick out of this song is a very Beatles zone, like a, Hey Jude kind of harmonies, bringing in the whole, it's mostly the vocals that were sort of connecting back to Beatles, like they sort of sing together. So here, I don't know if they're singing together really,
But
or
like
it's just,
the
yeah.
harmony or the
So
the
it's,
chorus feels
I think
like.
it's maybe just the vocals are similarly produced, maybe, or the process this in the
It
same
could
way
also
as
be
the Beatles
John's
song.
voice sounds a bit more similar to what you'd expect from something like the Beatles. Because like Roger, who generally sings the Who songs,
Maybe,
right?
yeah.
He's got a very like sharp voice. Like he's always almost yelling, I'd say, more than singing, like hard rock. But John's voice is, I think, a lot more low register.
So I guess, yeah, that's why I thought.
I think the lyrical content, like the wife coming after him and him wanting to buy a tank and an aeroplane and all of that. It reminds me more of almost like, like the 2000s, like punk rock era. Because you had a lot of songs within like, things like The Offsprings, Good Charlotte, Blink-182. There were a lot of songs they did which were just sort of taking a concept and just going crazy with it. Just like, so it gives me that like punk rock type of feeling, even though it's not really punk rock. The music, but I could very, very easily imagining like the Offsprings having a song like this, titled My Wife. And again, I'd like to mention Keith Moon's drumming. Like he's one of those guys where you give him a simple beat. Like I imagine that, say you got Keith Moon here and you say, "Hey Keith, you'll play this beat." He will never play the beat you ask him to because he'll start playing it and then he'll just start doing his own thing and there'll be like. Like a drum roll after drum roll. And you can feel it in this song as well. It's a simple beat, but then he just makes it his own. He never plays anything just straightforward. And I think it really comes out in this song. That's always like a fun song, a lighter toned song compared to the rest of the album.
I think, yeah, I agree with, I mean, again, I haven't gone deep into the lyrics, so I can't really get there.
I mean, the lyrics are
But
mostly
yeah,
about a
guess.
guy, him running away from his wife, sort of. He didn't come home because he got arrested, and now his wife is gonna kill him, so
Yeah, I
he
guess
wants to
we're
buy
gonna
a.
get into the lyrics when we do the Lifehouse project. But hang on,
That'll
this
be
wasn't in the
interesting.
Lifehouse
Yeah,
project.
this wasn't in the Lifehouse. This is the only song that wasn't, so. But yeah, I think it's just a fun song. So then from My Wife, we get to The Song Is Over. And this song was originally supposed to be the ending of Lifehouse, I think. And it is a much sort of slower and mellower song, so to speak. But it still has like a synth drone in the background. And it's sort of, I don't know if you noticed, but it's sort of like a duet between Pete and Roger. They both sort of sing. like alternating verses of the song.
So who's singing the beginning of it?
So Pete is singing the slower parts. You know, the song is over. The song is over. And right. I think Roger is the one singing the hard rock parts, like, I'll sing my song to the wide open spaces. Because, mm-hmm. like, again, this song, you know, like we sort of mentioned before, it transitions between that, like, soft acoustic to, like, a hard rock to then soft acoustic to then hard rock. And then Pete sort of sings that softer part. And then Roger comes in with a strong voice on the hard rock part. So it kind of takes you on your feet.
I have this noted down that love how it throws us, you know, like in the beat and the rhythm, which is kind of rare for a song, at least in my experience. Like, you know, that it's either the beat or the rhythm that sort of pushes you into it. But over here, it's the beat and the rhythm that you sort of take away and maybe hum along the whole song. Something like that.
And then also this song, it feels a lot more like, this definitely feels like a rock opera type of song. And what I mean by that is, if you listen to the song, you can imagine like the characters like walking around emoting as they sing it. Like if you add some background dancers, you got a musical, you know, like it's got that feel to it where they're talking to the audience through singing. And, you know, and the emotions jump very quickly to like from like this mellow, like the song is over, you know, the end has come sort of, and then you got, then suddenly I'll sing my song to the white. So it jumps very quickly between the emotions, and it gives me the feeling of like a musical. Like I can definitely see this being performed as like a rock opera slash like a live performance, you know, musical sort of thing.
I mean, very honestly, I could see a very John Denver song here. The song
is over. Yeah.
There's a full John Denver feeling into the song.
Yeah.
At least in the beginning of it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, the lyrical content as well, you know, it feels sort of about, because, you know, now that I sort of know that it was supposed to be towards the end of the Lifehouse film rock opera, you know, the song does feel like it's about endings, but like also like new beginnings. Because like, I think the part that Pete sings is sort of like ending, you know, like this chapter is ending, it's over. And then the part that Roger sings, it feels like, but I've got a new chapter to start. It's sort of, it's like that in-between feeling you can have, you know, when you're sort of, you're in a transition in your life, you know, moving from a job to a new job or changing schools or whatever it might be. It sort of feels like that, you know, bittersweet feeling of an ending, but you're excited about the new beginning, which is what Roger, I think, embodies with his voice. But yeah, an interesting sort of duet. Between the two, and then
now
from
that I know it's a duet, it's quite I will give it another listen, because otherwise I was just getting confused, hang on, is this the same guy or not? But I mean, I was enjoying the music, because as I said, like, you know, the rhythm and the beat throws you into it, but I will try to demarcate the rock
that
and
in
the
mind.
You know,
it's very subtle, but you know, Pete's done that, I think, even before in songs, like before this album, but it's very evident in this album because a lot of the songs have it, that like alternating between that rock, hard rock, and then more softer piano verses, keeping it dynamic. And
we see that later on in Behind Blue Eyes as well.
Yeah, so even like, in this next song that we have, Getting Into You, you know, this is another sort of relatively speaking sort of lighter song, but it does have that alternating sort of between, you know, that soft piano to more rock verses. This is all Roger singing, but Roger sings the two parts slightly differently. What were your sort of impressions of this? I don't think you would have heard this song before you heard it for Shuffling Notes.
I had heard this. Okay. I mean, as I said, I've heard, I think I heard all of these songs before, because you know who.
Yeah.
But this song is like, it's got a, a predictable tune because you flow into it.
Yeah.
So you can sort of see how the stream is going. So
yeah,
you can sort of take yourself with it. And
yeah,
it sort of, by the end, it gets into a lot of everyone sing with me kind of song.
Yeah,
everyone's sort of singing together, maybe, or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's it. And I love the tune of Getting in Tune.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know if you paid attention to the lyrics, but it feels like, because it's sort of about running out of things to say in a song. He starts it off, I'm singing this note because it fits in well with the chords I'm playing. I can't pretend there's any meaning here or in the things I'm saying. I like to say, it's sort of like existential writer's block, because it's like, as an artist, you're having like a writer's block. You don't know what to write, and you write a song about that as you get all existential. Sure. Like, what is the meaning of a song, So it's kind of about music, losing its meaning. And I did wonder when I heard it, how much of it could also be relevant to like what the Who as a band were going through, because you become mainstream and you still have to keep producing songs. And then obviously there's a type of sound that your audience comes to expect of you. And and you see it with a lot of mainstream artists, they start off writing their own songs, and then they get like shadow writers, or they'll get other writers to write songs, and they will just restrict themselves to performing them. Just because, they've run out of things to say. And I feel like it embodies that a little bit. I did see, like, Pete has said that this song sort of reflects his struggle between, like, his sort of search for spiritual development and then his, like, persona as a rock star, which is, also there. But yeah, I just, it's an interesting song. It has that shift between, like, a softer, mellower part to a hard rock part, like, Getting in Tune, right on you, and it has that like dynamic shift.
I really enjoy that.
But yeah, and again, like, the I don't know if you noticed right at the beginning, there's like this sick bass riff that again catches my attention right at the beginning. Like, the bass in all the songs is very unique, but it's one of those things that you don't notice it because it's bass, it's in the background.
Yeah.
Until you like put it in your mind to notice it, but it's very unique. And from Getting in Tune, then we get to the next song, which is called Going Mobile. So this song, there's actually no Roger on this song. This was recorded as a trio with like Pete and John and Keith, and Pete is sort of singing the lead vocals in this. And yeah, I mean, like, it's kind of fun. It's sort of about traveling, living in like a camper van, constantly traveling. Again,
basically
I'd say it's
mobile.
Yeah, it's sort of a lighter, more fun track. I wonder what your sort of impressions were.
I don't have any special notes on it, but
yeah,
there is a Hindi song which just reminded me of.
Interesting. Yeah.
But I couldn't think of it, and I guess I'll get to it whenever I come
back
across that Hindi
somewhere.
Song.
Yeah.
But there is that sort of, I mean, it probably is an inspiration in the Hindi song that we hear. But yeah, it's I see. I've sort of heard that sort of tune in, I think, a movie song or something.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, like, I don't know if you noticed, but there is a guitar solo in this song as well. And it isn't, so like Pete has sort of plugged in his guitar into like a synth, and he's got like this wah-wah sounding audio. But it's a very unique guitar sound, like guitar solo, I felt like, because it's almost like it's a synth playing. I've heard people describe it as like, it's like he's playing the guitar underwater. But I just think it's like, the trio having fun with it. Because if you try and isolate just the drumming and the bass as well, like what Keith and John were doing, they're also just going crazy. Like, they're just doing all types of things in this song. And it's just, again, I guess the band having fun. In this case, the trio themselves having fun. And, you know, just a bit more background. I know we'll probably do like a Lifehouse video, but this song was again about, I think, in that Lifehouse concept in the future, because of pollution and everything, you're not allowed to travel, I think. This is sort of rebelling against that. But it does then point out, you know, there's a line about pollution and all of that in there. But it, you know, it's just having fun with the concept, I think.
Makes sense. And really like how so far we've just, you know, it's the band is just having fun, because
there's a point that,
yeah
I think, you know, it's very much, and I'll get to this a little bit in this when we sort of conclude this video, but like the Who, they were never a very unified band. There was always a lot of conflict within the band. Mm-hmm. A lot of it was public as well. And I think in the music, especially in something like Going Mobile, like you can hear each band member is kind of just doing their own thing. They're all very unique artists. And so when they come together to create music, it's not as streamlined as other music might be, but it's just so unique sounding. Which is, I think, gives that Who sound, you know, that classic Who sound, is every member just kind of just doing their own thing.
Is that why it's called Who?
I mean, they were originally called the Detours, and then their name changed to the High Numbers, and then they changed the name to the Who. So they kind of went over a few different names over the period. But yeah, I mean, we'll discuss more about it towards the end, because I think some of it is more evident in the tracks coming out. But it's just, in this song, you know, the drumming is ridiculous, the bass is also ridiculous, the lyrics and the song itself is ridiculous, and then you got Pete, who's playing his guitar plugged into a synthesizer. You know, Roger said it. I remember watching an interview a while back. One of them, it might be the producer who said it, I think it was Roger. You know, he was kind of disappointed, because he thought, you know, we have one of our best guitarists, and he does this really, like, great guitar solos and stuff. And now he's doing all this crazy synth stuff I don't understand, you know. But it worked out for the best, I think. You know, it gives it this unique sound. The song as well as the overall album with all the synth stuff. But you can imagine, like, each band member just going down their own rabbit hole of doing things. Conflict.
Yeah, I see a lot of experiment and, you know, individual experiments that sort of are collaborated together.
Exactly.
And they just sound good.
Yeah, that really, I feel like, is the spirit of the Who.
Nice.
So, yeah, from Going Mobile, then we come to Behind Blue Eyes. Again, I probably one of the more sort of famous Who songs. And, you know, this song, it does have a bit of a background story. You know, it was, I think, you know, something happened after a live performance. I think there was, you know, Pete Townshend was like, there was some groupie that came to him. But, you know, he didn't sort of entertain that. He just kind of went back to his room. And that's when he kind of got inspired to write some lines that later turned into this song, Behind Blue Eyes. And, you know, this song was supposed to be in Lifehouse, and it's supposed to be from the perspective of the villain, who kind of feels like he's the good guy. Which is sort of, you know, that's how it's sort of been used in pop culture as well. You know, the song has been used in lots of TV shows and movies.
Yeah, there's also, I think, what's that?
Superstition?
Superstition. Yeah, so the superstition is, there is a superstition behind Blue Eyes. You know, not to, again, I don't know where does it stem from, but there is that the saying that, you know, a blue-eyed person is not to be trusted.
I've heard that as well. I think specifically, I don't know how prominent it is here in the West, but I've definitely heard that in India and so forth, like this saying of blue eyes. And actually, very good parallel you've drawn here with the Behind Blue Eyes part.
Well, it's Behind Blue Eyes.
Yeah. That's quite cool. And you know, it's definitely, you've got that feeling of, you know, it's, you can relate to it without even thinking about a villain or a hero. I mean, like, we've all done things that, you know, choices in life that we know it's the right choice, but you can't help mm-hmm. feeling like the jerk in the situation just because how things played out. And I think it, you know, the song really kind of captures that type of feeling. But I do want to point out, I think Roger and Pete, they both really identify with this song, but they identify quite differently. So, mm-hmm. you know, Roger, the main singer, he's always been the person when he was young to who'd get into fights. Like, for him, the way to resolve things was to punch the other guy. Like, that's how things were for him, and you know, growing up. So he kind of identifies it as like holding back that anger and rage, you know, holding back that violence, you know. You know, when my fist clench, crack it open, and so forth. Mm-hmm. But Pete has a different way. Like, he's also performed this song solo, like singing it live, Pete. And I think he's released a version of it with him singing later on in one of the albums as well. And I think his interpretation has to do more with love. But I just thought it's interesting that you've got band members into, you know, having different, like the singer has sang it in a way that's different from how Pete wrote it, perhaps, you know, and it goes back to that uniqueness of who. But yeah, I mean, you know, Roger's voice really shines in this song. You know, again, it starts off mm-hmm. more acoustic, stripped down, before then the rock section kicks in. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you noticed, there's like halfway through, like there's this guitar riff, you know, when that rock section has kicked in, and it's the same rhythm, it's the same sort of sound that's used in the bridge of the next song, Won't Get Fooled Again. I don't know if you noticed that. There's like that. It's only there for like a couple of bars. But I just thought, again, it shows just, that these songs belonged on that Lifehouse project, you know. And again, this is a song that could be in like a musical. You can imagine like the lead, or like I guess the antagonist, walking on the cliffs and singing this song, looking into the sun, you know, something like from, like, dare I say, something like High School Musical. But you know, you can definitely see like a musical being played out, and you can see that rock opera roots in this song.
So I was just saying that you know, I have no notes for this song, because you know, while I'm listening to the song begins, and I'm like, okay, I'll pay attention to whatever parts sort of stand out for me. And the song ends, and I'm like, hang on, that just went away. It's
because you just heard the whole thing.
You're just going, throughout this week, it's just set me into this zone where, I forget time that way. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's how you know it's good music.
That's how you know it's good music.
So then from Behind Blue Eyes, we get to the last track, Won't Get Fooled Again. The lyrics in the song itself, it's again inspired by Meher Baba, but also Inayat Khan. You know, Pete was a follower of both these people. And it has, you know, they use a similar synth technique to which they used in Baba O'Reilly, you know, for the organ synth sound that they have. And I have to say, you know, this is one of my favorite Who songs, Won't Get Fooled Again, because of the music, but also, and I think we'll get into the lyrics and the content, but it is a song that I come back to quite a lot, and I feel it applies to a lot of things in life, apart from what they're just thinking, you know, singing about. But yeah, you know, what's your sort of insight into this?
You know, getting into the, firstly, just mentioning, you know, you know, this song, this title was just added to a tune that sort of went with it.
Working on. Yeah.
And
a little something. Yeah.
Besides that, I'd like in the lyrics, I like how they play with like there's a God and music conundrum, because you know, he sings with, I pick up my guitar and play just like yesterday, and then I get on my knees and pray. You know, that sort of transition of, I think maybe just by the end of the day, or like it's how a full
Yeah.
day is pictured, maybe, or it's how maybe a few years in the past are pictured. That, you
Yeah.
know, I've been doing that for so long, and now
Exactly.
I
It's
just have to get on
like a
my knees and
routine.
pray.
Yeah. So I mean, it's, you know, the song itself, it's sort of, it's well, it's the longest track. It's like what, 8.5 minutes, and it really is about, it's sort of about like revolutions, and like they don't always mean what people think they mean. So like, you know, there's often a revolution and you're like, okay, you know, this is a big fight, you know, we're all uniting against XYZ, and like this revolution will lead to, you think it will lead to X, like this is what's going to happen. But by the time the revolution actually happened and everything gets over, you end up somewhere completely else, or perhaps, you know, you're back where you started. So in the sense that revolutions come and go, but things don't really change. And so that's why the lyrics are sort of like that, you know, like I'll tip my hat to the new constitution, take a bow for the new revolution, but pick up my guitar and play just like yesterday. And then, you know, I'll pray that we don't get fooled again. Because people, you know, there's a quote by someone, like, it's easy to fool people who are already fooling themselves. And I think in revolutions, or in even you could say wars, or you know, there's, when you have like large patriotism and all of this, and when even like governments, when they're changing, when there's elections, oftentimes there's people fooling themselves because they believe, if I vote for this person, this is going to fix every problem in my life. You know, you come to that belief that it's going to fix every single thing instead of focusing on maybe it might fix this one thing. And, you know, governments come and go, revolutions come and go, and more often than not, they don't change much. It's just all empty promises. And,
true.
You know, once people get the power, they, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. Putting a lot of quotes in here. But, you know, that's why it's one of the songs I really, it's just, it's not, and I think, you know, they've asked Pete about this as well. And he says, you know, it's not anti-revolution as so. It's not saying don't do revolutions and stuff, but it's just pointing out that don't fool yourselves into thinking this will fix every single thing.
Right.
And then there are lines in the song that to me just stand out. You know, there's this one line, like, I know that the hypnotized never lie. And what that means is, you know, when you're having an argument with someone who really believes in a cause or a revolution and they're telling you it's going to fix everything, they're not lying to you. They believe it. But then they've been hypnotized by, like, you could argue the leader or the government or whoever they're following. So it's just, it's written quite beautifully, I think. And it's,
that's,
you know.
I mean, I think that's what will put the Who into the revolutionary music pioneers, even, because you know, everyone doing their own thing in and getting together and making a full album out of it, a few albums out of it, is, you know, well, that's revolutionary, as well as what they sing about, how they sing about it, is also revolutionary, you know.
Yeah, I imagine, like, again, something with something like Won't Get Fooled Again, even like something like Bargain, which was the second song, you know, Pete's like writing these really deep thoughts and lyrics. And I can imagine the rest of the band just coming in and just doing like a rock song, you know, like for them, it's like, oh, yeah, this is good. But Pete's like getting all, you know, existential and you know, even with the music, with like the synth and, you know, even the synth in this, you know, you got that organ and synth sound. But the original idea for both this song as well as Baba O'Reilly was that the synth sound was supposed to be. So they were building this. Well, Pete was trying to build this music system in which you could input like personality information about a person, like their biographical data, their horoscope, like those type of things. And then that machine would generate some sort of music or sound that encompasses that person's personality. It was some crazy idea. So it went from the plot of Lifehouse to Pete wanting to actually do it in real life. He was like, rather than writing a movie or rock opera about it, why don't we actually create it? And then I think, you know, they hit a lot of roadblocks. And so in the end, he ended up just using the organ and the synth setup to create those type of sounds. But it was supposed to be originally like this crazy electronic futuristic system that sort of writes music or produces chords and notes based on personal data that's been inputted to it. So it was this crazy idea. And it comes through in the music, you know. Again, with Won't Get Fooled Again, you've got this diversity of the rock and the synth and the organ and all these different things coming together. And yeah, and it kind of just keeps going on and on towards the end again. The lyrics sort of end and the music keeps going. And then they just say like two lines, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, which again goes back to that, you know, revolutions apart.
So I'm going
to
ask you, since you clearly, or you will always clearly just go really deep into this. Like, is there a full-fledged theme, as you said, like there's a story that's running through it. So what's the target that they're reaching for?
So do you mean like in terms of Lifehouse? The what's the sort of...
Probably, yeah. You know, just these nine songs, these nine OG songs.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so just backing up a little. So they, the previous rock opera Tommy was about a guy who's deaf, dumb, and blind, but he's really good at playing pinball. and then this, you know, that's oversimplifying a little bit, but I always find that funny that he's so good. He's the pinball wizard. You know, we got to do Tommy at some point as well. We have to do it in parts because it's like a really big rock opera. And there's a film as well. But yeah, anyways, so this Lifehouse project and this, these nine songs, I think, together, you know, they're really about... I think, you know, Pete has said it in his own words, I think, that he kind of wanted to write and it was again about someone being almost like deaf, dumb and blind from the world. But then the way they approached it is this is set, this whole concept is set in the future where everyone is like plugged into like the mainframe, like a VR sort of system. Mm-hmm. And you have to wear these suits to like travel around. That's why I remember going mobile is like rebelling because you're traveling. And so in a way, all your experiences are through this virtual reality, and so you're deaf, dumb, blind to the real world. And I think that's what the songs encompass. And when you come to Won't Get Fooled Again, you know, that was again near the climax of the song where I think, you know, the government, there's some sort of war going on in that story as well. Right. And in the end, they end up doing this live, you know, in that Lifehouse story, there's a live performance of sorts where these people go and attend and everyone listening, it's almost mm-hmm. like the rapture. They kind of ascend because they use this, again, electronic system to create this, I think it's called the universal chord or whatever, that like, you know, there's like a spiritual ending to it. And I think a lot of these songs sort of encompass that. So I think Won't Get Fooled Again structurally. I think in Lifehouse, I think that went right before the song is over. So I think Won't Get Fooled Again was like the big climax. Mm-hmm. And then everything gets over. And then perhaps we had that song. You know, the song is over, which is like about endings and new beginnings. But I'm not entirely sure. You know, perhaps I'll look into it before we do a Lifehouse video. But so the songs on the nine tracks that we have here, I feel like they kind of embody parts of that. You know, Won't Get Fooled Again. Again, it's about...
Just to add, we've already done a Lifehouse video.
This will be the Who Lifehouse video. But yeah, that's true. Already done Lifehouse video. But yeah, I think, you know, so a lot of the songs, you know, there's spiritual soul seeking, like Bargain, you know, Bubba O'Reilly. And, you know, mm-hmm. again, getting in tune, the song is over. Again, there's, I would say, it's like soul searching. Right. And Behind Blue Eyes also has, you know, elements of that. Like, am I the bad mm-hmm. guy? Questioning it. And I think Won't Get Fooled Again is such a fitting climax to all of these songs.
I agree. Yeah.
You go through that spiritual soul searching, but you're not fooling yourself with anything. You know, you're still in touch True. With reality. You know, pick up my guitar and play just like yesterday. And you can even take it in a spiritual sense. You know, sometimes people go on like, you know, meditation retreats and you know, these travels. And when they come back, they're like, oh, I'm enlightened now. Whatever that means. And you know, for a week or 2 weeks or for a month, they'll be like, I'm enlightened now. But slowly they start falling back into like, you same know, the same. Routine. So it's kind of like about being aware of that spiritual side, but you're not fooling
yourself. Just to reference, you know, Welcome to the Machine by Pink Floyd. It's just the same thing. Like you know, welcome to the machine. This is what it is.
Yeah, essentially, right. So it's you know, and like I said, the lyrics and everything. You know, I really find it written so well. Going back to "Won't Get Fooled Again," you know, like the men who spurred us on sit in judgment of all wrong. They decide, and the shotgun sings the song. And it's like, you know, all the generals and leaders making the decisions behind the scenes, and right. people getting caught up in like, this is, you know, again, not, it's like they've said, not saying anything against people in the military or in the army or anything, but this is just sort of like a take or a perspective on that, a slightly different perspective of not getting fooled again. And yeah, I mean, it's got that full sending, and it starts back up again with the music, you know. I think it's a great, great climax. So yeah, I think, I guess just summarizing the album again, which we sort of did already, I would say this is the Who at their peak. That doesn't mean it's necessarily the best album, but I feel like each separate individual, when they were recording this album, right. were at their peak of experimenting with music, at being, you know, cocky, having an ego, but just doing it, you know, just going with it and being allowed to do it. And I think it kind of shows.
Yeah, it's funny because so there's this, I mean, this exact sort of setup is there in Pink Floyd's, I don't know how you pronounce it. It's Umaguma or Amaguma, however you pronounce it. So there's this album which is the least liked by the band, Pink Floyd, because in that one album, everyone's doing their own thing. There are a few sections of the song which are by you know, David Gilmour. Then there's the drummer. There's like different sections are a one of the members' sort of perceptions of the music. So that is what they don't like. While here we see
and it shows like Pink Floyd songs generally, like everything like blends in perfectly. Yeah. You know, each sound is like carefully chosen, even though it's experimental. But with The Who, it almost feels like, you know, you get these four very unique artists. You know, Keith Moon's drumming is not normal drumming. He does some crazy drumming. Same with John Entwistle's, you know, bass playing. He's like a lead bass player. He's not like a background, you know, rhythm bass player almost. And then you got Pete Townshend, who's like doing all these crazy things with his guitar and his synth. I mean, you know, it's and Roger's like live jumping around, throwing mics around and waving them around. You know, it's this crazy combination. And then at the end, all of them, imagine like they're like smashing up their instruments. They're smashing the guitar against the drum while playing, you know. So it's just this very crazy, destructive combination, because they destroyed their instruments at the end, that ends up creating this, you know, almost like genre-bending music of like synth with rock with, you know, all these different sounds. It's almost, it's very like genre-bending.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
You know, the
imagine...
other thing is... Yeah, go ahead.
So I can only imagine like... so there's this Woodstock festival from 1969, I think, that so people from like musicians from around the world were called in from India and then from the West. And they all sort of collected in one place, and you can hear or you can see that there's a movie called Montreux Pop where you see you know, Pandit Ravi Shankar playing on stage and Jimi Hendrix sitting in crowd and just watching him.
Yeah.
And then when Jimi Hendrix is playing, he just, you know, he breaks his guitar, he lights it up on fire and stuff on stage.
You know, there's a story behind that as well, I think. If I remember correctly, I'll have to double check this. But I remember with Jimi Hendrix doing Lighting the Guitar on Fire, The Who were really pissed with them, because I think The Who were also performing and they kind of felt like Jimi stole their act. Because so back at that time, the crowd used to go crazy with the Who destroying the instruments, and a lot of the audience would just go to see their performance, just to see the Who destroying their instruments at the end. And so Jimmy did it, and then I remember reading about it, but I can't remember what exactly the context of it was. But there was an element to, like, they kind of felt cheated out of it. Then there was a story with Pandit Ravi Shankar as well, because he was really upset. You know, he saw it, all of this, as like disrespectful to music, like destroying the instruments, and he was severely upset about that.
Imagine. You know, the way you put it, as people, some people went to watch the Who destroy the instruments.
Yeah.
And you know, the Who also probably enjoyed destroying the instruments by the end of it, because you know, their music was so hardcore rock that they just went so much in the flow that they went crazy, basically. While on the other side, we have the Doors, Jim Morrison, where Jim Morrison used to do his crazy acts on stage.
And,
you know, I think John or someone mentions that, Robbie mentioned that it's strange that, you know, when I met Jim first time, and he seemed like a normal guy until, you know, he was he didn't come for the first time jamming, because he was arrested, and that's when these guys thought that that guy's a weirdo. But, you know, I'm saying that Jim Morrison sort of did not like him being portrayed in this, you know, shenanigan, I would say. And Who enjoyed this. So it's like, you know, there's so many connections.
Very different,
that's just coming out of this.
I just Googled it. Yeah, they had a Jimi Hendrix, and I think, you know, I can't remember, some member of the Who, they had some backstage argument as well about who would go first, because neither of them wanted to follow the other. This is 67. But I remember reading about this, Monterey Pop Festival, and the shenanigans with Pandit Ravi Shankar, Jimi Hendrix, and The Who, and all the drama that kind of went on behind the scenes and stuff.
It would be another dream, it would be my Disneyland, basically. You know, that... There's just you
and
watching.
This was sort of, you know,
Ravi Shankar, you're watching Jimi Hendrix, Who, and
imagine at the same concert. It's crazy. And, you know, they had this. There was also in the US this thing going on called the British Invasion, right? With like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and now the Who, like all these British bands becoming popular and influencing US music. So there was quite a bit going on, you know, in that 1960s to 70s period. Yeah, quite an interesting sort of anecdote there. I guess coming back to this album, Who's Next, you know, I think one other thing that I just like to mention is it's quite interesting to hear, and I think you'll also realize this perhaps now that you know more about the background. Like, hear some of the more like spiritual sounding lyrics in songs like Bargain, but they sang so aggressively in like a rock song, right? So, like, a lot of the lyrics are, like, about not fighting, or about, like, you know, even Baba O'Reilly, you know, I don't need to fight to prove I'm right. I don't need to be forgiven. You know, it's not about, but the way it's sung and the music is so hardcore that it almost feels like, if you're not listening to lyrics, you'd imagine the song is about fighting. So there's this dichotomy of, like, a spiritual sounding song in terms of lyrics, but the music is very hard rock. Because generally, even with rock bands, you know, when they have those existential songs, usually it's an acoustic song or it's a stripped down song. It's not a hard rock, you know, music accompanying it. And then, you know, I guess so much energy went into Lifehouse. And then with this album, Who's Next, they kind of took the Cliff Notes and, you know, some of the best parts of Lifehouse, and they put it into this album of 9 songs. And no wonder I think it did so well. But I mean, Pete has, I think, you know, he's got some mixed feelings, I guess, about the album. You know, he's glad they did it, but there were some songs that were like core to Lifehouse that didn't end up on this album that he feels like, you know, are needed. And he's released something called the Lifehouse Chronicles box set and things later on that we could perhaps have another video about. But it's just such a unique album that was a result of like so many crazy things happening that you know, led to these songs.
You know, when you selected this these nine songs of this album, the OG album, I would say.
Yeah.
I really had to sort of, you know, change my mind.
Yeah.
To get into these, you know, these really maddening songs, like maddening in the sense of, you know, the way they're approaching their instruments, their vocals, their style it's like an outrage, probably.
Yeah. I'll send you. You know, they've uploaded some of their older live performances, and I'll send you some of the links. Like, it is, you can see, you know, as crazy as the music sounds, their live presence is just as crazy, if not crazier, of them like jumping around. And even when I went to see The Who a couple of years back, and it was, you know, mostly just Roger and Pete playing together. And they're old people now, you know, they still have that energy when they're live, and that you still see them like feeling, you know, they're sort of jumping around, and, you know, Pete does this, like, he's got this trademark like guitar playing style where he just like takes his hand all the way around. So, you know, they still have that energy to them, which I think is like the core of who they are. And it really comes through in, especially in the songs in this album. You're like, Bob O'Reilly towards the end, where this like they're speeding up the beats, and like the music keeps going crazy and crazier. And towards the end of Won't Get Fooled Again as well, you know, they've got that long musical interlude towards the end. We're just playing the music and going on and on. It really captures that live essence a little bit, I think.
I just want to add, you know, since we're now sort of concluding it. The way we've sort of drawn or seen inspirations here and there, or maybe adaptations, or maybe original work itself. I like, so what you're explaining, how they're at this age and they're doing what they're doing as if they were like in their 20s, 30s.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just because they love music.
Yeah.
And guess who else loves music?
the whole reason for the channel's existence.
So, just drawing inspirations, I guess.
I mean, it's, you know, especially this is true with The Who, like, the way that each band member performs, you know, like, it's very akin to, like, because even before, I hadn't heard The Who when I was younger. I've only heard them over the recent years, the past probably 4 or 5 years. I've been exposed to their music more, and I've been listening to them more intently. But it's just, you know, the way that they have the drumming, the bass, all these things is very similar to like how I always approached music and instruments, where, like, you know, we had in school, like when there was that band, sort of a band, with some of the friends, which you remember. And then we had, you know, one of the drummers, like, the main reason we had that drummer was because he would never play what we told him to play. He would, like, you tell him a beat, like, this is the beat, or you play the song for him if he hasn't heard it. Oh, that's the song we're doing. He'll listen to it once, and he'll come up with something completely ridiculous that just sounds amazing. And I almost feel like, you know, that's almost like what a lot of the drumming in here sounds. It's like they take a beat, what a standard drum beat would be or rhythm would be, and he just turns it upside down. And same way that, you know, the bass is played, and the same way the guitar and the synth is played, it's very non-traditional, you know, it's very sort of unique approach to how they want to make it sound.
Yeah, and I guess that's how any music also rolls. It's once you get one of the instruments in place, and that's sort of playing the tune that you want the song to, you know, it's sounding good. So the rest of the instruments just fall into place. So you know, it's also
Well, you play good off each other, right? You have that chemistry as a band, and you can play
so
off each other.
So it's good to
So
have a few crazy people just, you know, get crazy.
Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, I think, you know, we could just go on and on. Especially yeah. me, I could just go on and on about Who. So, you know, I think we've got most of our sort of thoughts out. Is there any sort of final thoughts you want to sort of add to conclude, or?
No, not really. I mean, we've sort of covered all the craziness that we could.
Yeah. I look forward to doing sort of more, you know, I think more of the Who albums, you know. And one of the main reasons I selected this album was I was initially going to choose My Generation, which is like one of the first albums. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, between that, they've mostly released like singles and compilations and things. And then the actual albums like Tommy and then Quadrophenia and so on, they're like very big rock opera, so you would have to do them in parts. You know, there's no way to do all the songs in one video. So I thought Who's Next was like a really great first video on the Who. It really captures their essence, and then we can dive deeper in future videos, you know, in looking into their sort of rock operas and other songs. So yeah, I think, you know, that's about it, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you again next week with another video. Cheers.